but it was too late and the blade sang down to slice his jugular before smashing his collarbone and opening a great wound all the way to his lungs. He was dead before he hit the ground. The blade slid clear and slashed back in a reverse cut that opened the second man's belly clean through to his backbone. He alone had time to scream. The youngster had circled behind the knight, and now he leapt forward with knife raised. Without turning, the once knight dropped to his knee, spinning his sword so that the blade was between his right arm and his side. The boy did not see the danger until he was almost upon the kneeling man, and the sword clove into his chest, dissecting his heart. The once knight dragged his blade clear and stood. In the several seconds that the fight had lasted, the robber's leader had reached Kuan and grabbed for the reins. The stallion reared, his front hooves cracking into the thief's face, so that he stumbled back and fell heavily. A shadow moved across him, and he looked up.
"It was a foolish move, and your friends have suffered for it."
The man rolled to his knees, eyes wide in disbelief as he stared at the bodies.
"My son!"
he screamed, scrambling to the boy.
"You've killed my son!"
For some seconds he cradled the body, then stood and drew his own knife. The once knight said nothing, for he knew no words could dissuade him. With a piercing scream, the robber raced towards him. The longsword sang out. Sober now, the once knight climbed into the saddle.
"Come, Kuan. This place is no longer beautiful."
Since that day he had avoided towns, settlements, and even lonely cabins, until he reached the Duchy of Maktha. If Olathaer was anywhere, it would be here, in his homeland. The once knight drew his sword and gazed into the ruby pommel.
"Olathaer,"
he whispered. The jewel shimmered and darkened, an image forming at its heart. There, by a well, stood the armorer. And armed men were moving towards him, their swords bright in the moonlight.
"No!"
shouted the once knight, but the image faded. Erin rose from his bath and stepped into the black robe held out for him by Ubadai. His body glowing from the hot water, he moved to the window and felt the freshness of the night breeze. Ubadai poured a goblet of watered wine and carried it to his master, but Erin waved it away. "No drink tonight," he said.
"Something troubles you, lord?"
"Why do you stay in my service, Ubadai? I freed you 2 years ago and you could go wherever you want, back to the steppes, across the sea to Citheron, or into the east. Why do you stay?" Ubadai shrugged, his dark, slanted eyes showing no emotion.
"You should drink. Drink very much. Fall down, maybe."
"I do not think so. Go. Leave me." Erin watched as a nomad turned on his heel and strode from the room. He gazed down at the wine and shivered. Having closed the window, he walked to the far side of the room where a log fire blazed in a stone hearth. Dragging a heavy chair to the fireside, he sat and stared into the flames. The meeting with the seer, Okessa, haunted him, forcing its way into his mind again and again. He had never liked the man whose shaven head and curved nose gave the impression of a vulture, and his eyes always seemed to shine with a malevolent gleam. No, Erin did not like Okessa.
"It is rare that you take the time to consult me,"
the seer had said as Erin entered his study. "Our paths seldom cross," Erin replied, gazing at the shelves and the tomes placed there. "You have some interesting books. Perhaps I could borrow some."
"Of course, my lord. I did not know you were expert in the dead languages."
"I'm not."
"Then sadly the books would be of no value. How can I help you?"
Erin sat in a high-backed chair opposite the seer, who carefully laid his quill on the desk, pushing aside the book on which he had been working.
"I've come to seek your advice." A youth, a runaway, shouted a word. I think it was some kind of spell casting, for his running speed increased. I wounded him, but he escaped to the great forest.
And the word?
Olathair.
You are sure?
I believe so. My man, Ubadai, heard it also.
What does it signify?
Okessa leaned back and stroked his long nose with the index finger his right hand, his pale eyes fixed on Erin.
A dead wizard. He shouted the name of a dead wizard. Are you sure his speed increased? Could not fear have spurred him to greater urgency?
It is possible, but only just. I've never seen a man run faster, and as you know, I was master of the games last autumn in Firbolg. No, I think the word was one of power. Is that possible?
All things are possible, Lord Erin. Some artifacts of Olathair's survive, I believe.
The king beyond Citheron has a golden falcon, and King Ahak possesses a Gabalic sword which can cut through anything, even steel.
But these are priceless. How would a runaway slave obtain such an artifact?
Okessa stood and moved to the bookshelves, drawing down a leather-covered tome. Returning to his seat, he opened the book and carefully began to turn the pages.
Olathair, he said at last. Yes, here it is. The son of Caliban, 15th armourer to the knights of the Gabala. Olathair was apprenticed to his father in 1157 at the age of 13. He succeeded his father in 1170, so he would have been 26 then. In 1190, the knights vanished from history and we are left with merely legend, the most enduring of which is that they rode into hell to destroy the essence of all evil. Olathair was arrested as a traitor the following year and was put to death in the dungeons of Firbolg. There's also a brief description of his interrogation. No, I do not think you heard the boy correctly.
Could there be more than one Olathair? Erin asked.
If there was, my lord, be assured I would have heard of him. Was there anything else?
No, my lord seer, but I am grateful for your time and effort, said Erin, rising.
Please, do not leave quite so soon. There is a matter I wish to discuss.
Erin sat down.
It is the question of your household, my lord. You have some 6 nomad retainers, I believe.
Yes, and all loyal both to myself and to the crown.
The crown sees it differently. The king is about to issue an edict that all nomads be detained and sent to Gar Aden.
It is a desert.
You question the king's wishes?
Asked Okessa softly.
It is not for me to question my sovereign, it was merely an observation. However, the nomads in my employ are not slaves, and they're free to travel where they wish.
Not so, said Okessa, smiling.
No nomad can now enjoy citizenship, and all are under the king's express command to gather at Gar Aden. Those who do not obey are to be hunted down and slain, their goods and chattels taken by the crown or the crown's agents. In Maktha, the agent will, of course, be the duke.
And how, may I ask, are we to describe who is a nomad? They've been among us for hundreds of years. It is said that many noble families have nomad blood.
You know such families?
Okessa asked, leaning forward, his eyes gleaming.
Not with any certainty. Then be careful of what you say. It is decreed that the nomads are a tainted people, and they must be removed from the kingdom.
Thank you for this advance intelligence, said Erin, forcing a smile. Be assured, I shall act upon it.
I hope that you do.
By the way, this matter of Olothair intrigues me. Tell me, would you know of any craftsman or landholder around Macther with only one good eye? I do not make it my business to mix with the lower orders, Lord Seer, but I shall have inquiries made for you. Thank you. Would you treat the matter with some urgency? I will indeed. Erin had gone straight to the Duke, who took him to his private apartments in the West Tower. It is not for us to question a royal decree, the Duke pointed out. And let us not forget the question of increased wealth. You and I are in a fortunate position. Neither of us have any nomad blood in our family lines. We can only benefit. Erin had nodded. He'd always known the Duke was a hard and cruel man, but he had believed there was also a certain nobility of spirit in him. Now as he looked into the Duke's dark eyes, he saw only greed. The Duke of Macther stood and smiled. Taller than Erin, who had once been his page, he was a handsome man approaching 40 years of age, with a carefully cut and combed forked beard. Do not fret about a few peasants, Erin. Life is too short. I'm thinking of my manservant, Ubadai. He has been a faithful companion, and he saved my life, you remember? The bear hunt, when my horse fell. The beast would have torn me to pieces, but Ubadai leapt from his horse to the bear's back. A brave move. But is that not what we expect from our followers? Give him money and send him to Garadan. Now, let us move to happier matters. The king is coming to Macther in the spring, and I want you to be the lord of the feast. Thank you, my lord. You do me great honour. Nonsense, Erin. You are one of the finest organisers I know. The worst swordsman and the finest cook. The Duke had chuckled, and Erin had bowed and left the room. Now, here before the fire, his heart was heavy and his mind full of foreboding. Okessa was a snake, and it would be long before Erin would forget the malevolence in his eyes as he had asked, "You know of such families?" It was that alone which had saved the one-eyed craftsman, Ruad Rofessa. Erin would never deliver any man into the hands of the Lord Seer. But where did that leave him? Lost in thought, he did not notice Ubadai approaching.
"Food," said the servant, placing a silver tray beside Erin's chair.
"I am not hungry." Ubadai looked long into Erin's pale face.
"Some bad thing, eh? No drink, no food."
"You must leave Macther tonight. Take all nomad servants with you and make for the forest. Beyond it is the sea. Get as far from the realm as you can."
"Why?"
"To stay is to die. All nomads are to be herded to Garadan. It is a place of death, Ubadai. I can feel it. Prepare the servants."
"It is done," Ubadai assured him.
Ruad adjusted the silvered mirror and stropped his shaving blade against the leather hanging from the wall. Satisfied with the edge, he wetted his face with warmed water and carefully cut away the black and grey stubble. The face he saw was one that merited a beard, he thought. A heavy, all-disguising beard to cover the lantern jaw, and mask the gash of a mouth with its crooked teeth.
"You are uglier now than ever," he told his reflection.
Returning to his table, he pushed aside the remains of his breakfast and removed the bronze eye patch, polishing it with a soft cloth until it gleamed. Replacing it, he poured himself a goblet of apple juice and watched the coming dawn, the shadows shrinking back from the trees outside his window. He had been happier here than at the Citadel, for the old fortress held too many memories of his father. Caliban had been a stern parent to the son he had not wanted, and the boy, ugly and awkward, could do nothing to please him. Every day of his youth had been spent trying to win his father's love,
At last he had succeeded in the colors, proving himself a greater magician than Caliban. Then his father's indifference had turned to hatred, and he put the boy from him. Even when he was dying, he would not allow his son to sit by his deathbed. Poor Caliban, thought Ruad. Poor, lonely Caliban. He stood and forced the memories from his mind. For 3 hours he worked on his designs, then wandered out into the meadow beyond the woods to sit and enjoy the autumn sunshine. Soon the dark clouds would gather, the north wind howl, and the blizzards cover the mountains with freezing ice and snow. Already the leaves were turning to gold, the flowers fading. A distant figure caught his eye, making slow progress up the hill. Ruad waited as Gwydion approached.
"Lazing in the sunshine," said the newcomer,
his lined face red with the exertion of the climb, his white shoulder-length hair shining with sweat.
"You should buy yourself a horse," responded Ruad, rising to his feet. "You're too old for mountain walking."
The old man smiled, took a deep breath, and leaned on his staff.
"I've not the energy to argue," he admitted, "but a glass of your apple juice will revive me."
Ruad led him into the house and poured him a drink, while Gwydion sat down at the table.
"How is life treating you?"
the old man asked.
"I do not complain," said Ruad. "You?" "There is always work for a healer, even one with fading powers."
Ruad cut several slices of dark bread and a wedge of cheese, passing them to Gwydion. While the man ate, Ruad walked to the doorway, scanning the road to Macther. All was still.
"Orkessa is seeking news of a one-eyed craftsman," said Gwydion as Ruad returned.
"I do not doubt it. I made a mistake."
"You gave magic to the boy Lug?"
"Yes."
"That was not wise."
"Wisdom should be tempered with compassion," observed Ruad. "Did you come all this way to warn me?"
"Yes and no," replied Gwydion.
"I would have sent a message, but there is a pressing matter you might help me to resolve."
"You speak of the change in the colors."
"Then it is not all in my mind."
"Good," said Gwydion. "So my powers are not fading as fast as I believed."
"No, the red is swelling. The other colors fading. Green is suffering the worst, for it is the furthest."
"What is the cause?"
Gwydion asked.
"I know that the colors shift and dance, but never in such an extreme way. The green is now a shimmering thread. I'm hard-pressed to heal a sick calf."
Ruad moved to the hearth, cleared away the ash, and prepared a new fire. "I do not have any answers, Gwydion. There is an imbalance. The colors have lost their harmony."
"Has this, to your knowledge, happened before? I've never heard of such a thing."
"Nor I. Perhaps it will right itself."
"You think so?"
asked Gwydion.
Ruad shrugged. "There is an ugly feeling in the air," whispered the old man. "In Macther, there have been 3 murders in the last week. There is fear, Ruad."
"It is the influence of the red. It stirs the emotions. I felt it too, an impatience and anger that affects my work. Lately I have been unable to use the blue, so I've resorted to the black, but even that is fading." The old man shivered as a cold wind blew through the open doorway.
"Light the fire, Ruad. These aging bones cannot take the cold."
Lifting a thick branch from the hearth, Ruad ran his fingers along its length. Fire leapt instantly from the wood, and he thrust it into the prepared tinder. "The red, of course, still has its uses," he said, adding fuel to the blaze. Gwydion grinned.
"Not for healing, from which I earn my meager income."
Ruad closed the door and pulled 2 chairs before the fire,
Gwydion seated himself, holding out his hands through the dancing flames, and Ruad joined him. You will, of course, stay the night. You are most welcome.
Thank you,
Gwydion accepted. What other news have you? The healer shivered.
None that is good, I fear. A traveller from Firbolg says the city is in the grip of terror. A killer is stalking the streets. So far the bodies of 11 young women have been found, and 5 young men. The king has promised to hunt down the killer, but as yet there is no sign of any success. Added to this are rumours concerning the nomads. More than 1,000 were taken to Garadan, to what was described as a settlement. I have it on good authority.
Gwydion shuddered.
Strange how fire does not warm me as once it did. Do you think I'm close to death, Ruad?
I'm not a seer, my friend, said Ruad softly. You were talking of the nomads.
There is a pit near the mountains. I'm told 1,000 bodies lie there, with room for many thousands more.
It cannot be, Ruad whispered. Where is the logic? Who could gain from such a slaughter?
Gwydion said nothing for a moment. Then he turned towards the craftsman.
The king has decreed that the nomads are tainted, that they corrupt the purity of the realm. He blames them for all ills. You have heard of the nobleman, Kester.
I met him once, an irascible old man.
Put to death, said Gwydion. His grandfather wed a nomad princess.
I've never heard the like. Is there no opposition to the king?
There was, replied Gwydion. The king's champion, the knight Elladan, left his service. He stood up for Kester and demanded the ancient right to champion his honour. The king agreed, which surprised everyone. For there was not a finer swordsman than Elladan anywhere in the empire. A great crowd assembled for the combat in the jousting fields outside the city. The king did not attend, but his new knights were there. And it was one of these who stepped forward to face Elladan. The battle was fierce, but all who saw it, I am told, realized at once that Elladan had no chance against this new champion. The end was brutal. Elladan's sword was smashed to shards, and a blow to the helm sent him to his knees. Then the Red Knight calmly cut Elladan's right hand from his arm.
A Red Knight, you say? Whispered Ruad. Describe him.
I was not there, Ruad, but I'm told they appear only in full armor, their helm visors closed.
They? How many are there?
8. They are deadly. 6 times now they've fought in single combat for the king, and on each occasion a different knight takes the field, but all are invincible.
The old man shuddered.
What does it all mean, Ruad?
The one-eyed craftsman did not reply. Moving to the window, he pushed it shut, drawing the heavy woolen curtains to block any draught of cold air. Treat this house as your home, he told Gwydion. If you are thirsty, drink. If you are hungry, there is food in the pantry. Ruad strode through to his workshop, opening the chest by the far wall and rummaging through its contents. At last he found what he was seeking, a gold and silver rimmed plate, round and black as ebony. He carried it to his workbench and slowly polished it with a soft cloth. Satisfied, he closed his eye and reached into the colours. The red almost swamped him, but he rose through it, seeking the white. The colours were shimmering, receding. The white was a slender ribbon now, but he fastened to it, finding calm. His eye snapped open. Taking a curved knife from the bench, he pricked his thumb, allowing a single drop of blood to fall to the plate. As it touched the ebony, it disappeared.
and the black plate became a silver mirror in which Ru'ad gazed down at his reflection.
Olifair, he said.
A mist covered his image, then cleared as if a ghostly wind was blowing, and Ru'ad found himself staring down at the great hall in Firbolg. The king was seated on his throne, and around him stood 8 knights in red armor. Ru'ad's concentration increased. The scene grew closer still. The knight's armor was of a strange design, yet similar to the work he himself had designed for the Gabala. The helms were round, the neck rings overlapping. The shoulder plates were perfectly fitted, but boasted a high collar that would stop any swinging blade from harming the neck. Suddenly, as his examination continued, the tallest of the knights swung round. His head jerked up, and through the visor, Ru'ad saw a pair of blood-red eyes staring at him. The knight's sword flashed up. Ru'ad hurled himself back from his seat as the plate exploded, shards of burning metal slashing the air. One thudded into the doorframe, smoldering into flame, as Ru'ad rose trembling from the floor. The smell of burning wood hung in the air. Taking a deep breath and steadying himself, he moved around the room, stamping out the smoldering pieces. When he had finished, he returned to his seat. Gwydion entered.
"I'm afraid to ask," said the old man, "but I must. What did you find?"
"Evil," said Ru'ad,
"and there is worse to come. Much worse."
"Can it be countered?"
"Not by the likes of you and me."
"Then it must be terrible indeed,
if Olifair is powerless against it."
Ru'ad smiled. "I'm not powerless, my friend. I'm just not powerful enough."
"Is there any force in the world that could make you so?"
"The Knights of the Gabala," Ru'ad answered.
"But they are gone."
"Exactly. And I have surrendered the one weapon I had."
"What weapon is that?"
asked Gwydion.
"Secrecy. They know who I am, and worse, where I am."
Towards midnight, Ru'ad stirred in his chair. In the back room he could hear Gwydion snoring, and outside the autumn winds were rattling the window frames. He could not recall dropping off to sleep, but he had awoken refreshed, and now he stretched and rose. The fire was dying down. He thought of the old man and his inability to take the cold. Stepping outside, he walked to the wood store and gathered an armful of logs. The night was cold and, but for the sighing of the wind, quiet. 3 times more he carried wood to the hearth, building up the fire so that some warmth would remain at the dawn. Wide awake now, he wandered outside to the well. Just as he was about to lower the bucket, he glimpsed a moving shadow to his left and stood stock still, not turning his head. Then he sat down on the well wall and waited. They came in a rush, 7 swordsmen, all wearing the livery of the Duke, a black raven, wings spread on a field of green.
"I need you!"
bellowed Ru'ad. From the rear of the house came the sound of wood being splintered, and 3 golden forms bounded into the clearing. Shaped like hounds, yet larger than lions, they ran to Ru'ad and stood facing the armed men, jaws gaping, steel teeth shining in the moonlight.
"Good evening to you," said Ru'ad, standing to face the soldiers.
They stood very still, gazing at their leader, a slim young man carrying a long sword. He licked his lips nervously, tearing his eyes from the golden hounds.
"Good evening, craftsmen. We have been sent to escort you to Macther."
"For what purpose?"
"The Lord Seer, Okessa, has ordered your presence. I do not know his reason. But he asked you to come in the dead of night, armed and ready for war."
"He said you were to be brought at once, craftsman," said the young man, avoiding Ru'ad's gaze.
Return to Macther, and tell the Lord Okessa I am not subject to his bidding. Further, tell him I like not his method of invitation.
The young man stared at the golden hounds and their slavering steel jaws.
You would be wise, craftsman, to come with us. You would be declared a Nithing, an outlaw. I think, boy, it is time for you to leave.
Ruad knelt by the hounds, whispering words that the soldiers could not hear. The beasts moved forward, their eyes gleaming like red stars, and suddenly a ferocious howling came from them. As the men panicked and fled, sprinting down the hill, the golden hounds bounded after them, baying in the moonlight. Gwydion walked from the house to stand beside the craftsman.
How did they find you with such speed?
I do not know, but it does not matter now. I must leave here at once.
I will come with you, if you think I will not slow you down.
Ruad grinned. I would be glad of the company.
Those hounds! They tore through the back of the house. How many of those men will get back alive?
All of them. I did not order the hounds to kill. They will follow the men until they reach their horses, then they will return. Come, you can help me to gather my belongings. I wish to leave nothing behind me that can be used by the Duke or Okessa. Together the two men gathered the smaller artifacts in Ruad's workshop, placing them in a large canvas bag. There were also gold and silver ingots hidden behind the chest, and these Ruad loaded into two saddlebags, carrying them out onto the main porch. The hounds returned after an hour, and stood like statues under the stars.
Can I approach them?
Asked Gwydion.
Of course, they will not harm you.
The old man knelt by the lead animal, running his fingers over the overlapping plates of the beast's neck.
This is marvelous workmanship. Are the eyes rubies?
Yes. You think it overly dramatic? I thought to make them emeralds, but they are scarce.
They are perfect. I take it you cast the limbs from actual bones?
No, I copied a design of my father's. Hounds were his speciality. I just made them bigger.
Ruad carried the saddlebags from the porch, draping them across the gleaming backs of two hounds. Then he tied the canvas bag to the back of the third.
Wait here,
he told Gwydion. The craftsman returned to the house, and the old healer saw a bright flame spring up in the main room. Ruad wandered from his blazing home without a backward glance.
Let us go, he said.
The hounds silently padded alongside him. Chapter 4 Lamfada awoke, his eyes unfocused, his vision swimming. Lines ran above his head, dark lines, like the panelled lid of a coffin.
No!
He groaned, struggling to rise. A gentle hand pushed him back, and soothing words calmed him. His head rolled on the pillow, and he saw a young woman with dark brown eyes who stroked his brow.
Rest, she whispered. You are safe. Safe. Rest. I am with you.
When his eyes opened again, he saw that the lines were timbers, supported by a central beam. He turned his head, hoping the young woman was close by. Instead, he saw a man sitting by his bed, a handsome man in a sky-blue shirt. He had long, shoulder-length hair and was beardless. His eyes were violet. He smiled as he saw Lamfada looking at him.
Welcome back to the world, my friend.
The voice was soft and almost musical.
I am Nuada. I found you in the forest.
You saved me,
Lamfada whispered.
Not quite. There's another man with me. How do you feel?
My back is sore.
Lamfada licked his lips.
Thirsty, he said.
Nuada brought him a cup of water, supporting his head as he drank. You were struck by an arrow which lodged deep.
You have been in a fever for 5 days, but Arion says you will live.
Nuada spoke on, but sleep once more overcame the youth, and he dreamt of golden birds flying around the sun.
He awoke during a storm, hearing the shutters on the windows rattling and the rain pounding on the slanted roof. This time there was another man beside his bed, yellow-haired, with a red-gold beard and eyes the color of storm clouds.
"It is time you roused yourself, boy," the man told him. "You're costing me dear."
"Costing?"
"You think Arion and her mother do this for love? Much more time in bed, and I will be penniless."
"I'm sorry," said Lamfada. "Truly, I will repay."
"With what? I've already sold your dagger."
"Leave him be, Hlor,"
said a voice, and Lamfada saw a middle-aged woman come into view.
"He's not ready yet. It will be days before he can rise. Get out with you."
"Into the storm? Your charity fails to impress me. And the food smells too good to miss."
"Then behave."
The woman came to the bedside and rested a calloused hand on Lamfada's brow.
"Good. The fever is passing."
She leaned over the youth and smiled.
"You will be weak for a few days, but your strength will return."
"Thank you, lady.
Where is the other woman?"
"Arion is hunting. She will not be back tonight. She will have taken shelter from the storm, but you will see her tomorrow."
"A few more days," snapped Claw. "Already he is thinking of a pretty face. Put some broth into him and I'll wager he'll proposition her."
"Why should he not?" replied the woman, grinning. "Every other man has. But for you, Hlor Givis."
"I have no need of a woman," he said, and reddened as she laughed.
Lamfada slept again. The storm had passed by the time he woke. He seemed to remember being fed, but the memory was hazy, and his hunger was great. He sat up, but winced as a sharp pain pulled at his back. The young woman was kneeling by the hearth, striking flint against iron to light the tinder in the grate. Lamfada watched as a thin spiral of smoke rewarded her efforts, and, bending over the hearth, Arion blew the fire to life. He found himself staring at her hips and the stretched buckskin trews she wore.
"It is rude to stare," she said without turning. "How did you know I was staring?"
"The bed creaked as you sat up."
With the fire lit, she rose smoothly and walked to his bedside, pulling up a chair. Her hair was honey gold, her eyes deep brown, her mouth full, her smile an enchantment.
"Well?"
she asked.
"Well, what?"
he stammered.
"Am I fit for market? I don't understand. You are staring at me as you would a prize cow."
He looked away.
Forgive me, I'm not usually rude."
She laughed and took his hand.
"And I'm not usually so easily offended.
I am Arion. You?"
Lamfada.
"Are you sure? There seems to be some confusion."
"I am sure. I was called Lug, but I gave myself a good name, a man's name."
"Very wise. Lug does not suit such a pretty face. Why did you run away?"
"I was sold to the Duke. I thought it was better to run. Where am I?"
"In the forest of the ocean. Lord Givis brought you to my mother. You nearly died. He should not have pulled the arrow out. You almost bled to death."
"I don't know why he saved me. I seem to be causing him trouble."
"Do not concern yourself with Law. He is a contrary man, and few people understand him."
"What are your talents?"
I can cook, clean, and I have skill with horses. I play the flute.
Can you hunt, make clothing, fashion wood?
No.
Can you work clay?
No.
What about herbs? Would you recognize Amerian or Desarta?
I'm afraid not, the young man admitted.
Then life will be difficult for you, Lamfada. It would seem you are about as useful as a dead sparrow.
I can learn. Will you teach me?
You think I have nothing better to do.
Of course you have, but will you?
We will see. Are you hungry?
Ravenous, he admitted.
She brought him some cold venison and cheese, then gathered her bow and a quiver of arrows.
Where are you going?
She looked at him and smiled.
Isn't it obvious?
She said, holding up the bow.
I'm going to pick flowers.
After she had gone, Lamfada pulled back the blanket and eased himself from the bed. He looked around for his clothes and padded across to the hearth. His trews lay across the back of a chair, and he slipped them on. His shirt was hanging on a hook by the far wall, and he saw that someone had expertly sewn the hole made by the arrow. Once dressed, he sat down by the fire. His legs felt weak and unsteady. He added wood to the blaze and sat quietly, thinking of the terror of his flight and the sudden hammer blow as the arrow struck his back. He had been saved by Hlor Givis, the man he had come to join. But, as Arion had pointed out, he had little to offer the rebel leader. He felt suddenly foolish and worse, useless. The door opened and a blast of cold air touched him.
How the young recover, said Nuada. Good morning to you.
Lamfada smiled.
I remember you. Like a dream. You were sitting by my bed. Nuada, isn't it?
It is. I can see you're feeling stronger. But you shouldn't overstretch yourself. You really were extremely ill.
Arion tells me you are called Lamfada. A good name.
A Gabala knight, no less. One of the first, I think.
Yes, so I am told. Are you a rebel?
Nuada chuckled.
You know, I think that I am. But I fear I will strike no terror in the hearts of the king's soldiers. Saga poets are rarely swordsmen.
You are a poet?
Nuada bowed and sat down beside the youth. I am probably the best in the realm.
Do you know many stories?
Hundreds.
When you are feeling better, you must come to the hall. I perform there every night. I have become famous here. Men travel from settlements all over the forest to hear me. If they had any money, I would be rich.
Tell me of the Gabala Knights.
Rather wide area, covering 200 years.
Could you not be more specific? The tale of Lamfada, perhaps? Tell me of Olothair, said Lamfada.
Ah, a student of modern history, commented Nuada.
Do you know the origins of the knights? No, not really.
Weren't they rebels at one time?
Not quite.
The order was formed in 921 by the then King Albaras. They were judges. There were 9 of them, and they travelled the land adjudicating on disputes in the name of the king. But in 970, during the War of the Rebellion, they saved the king from execution and spirited him away to Cithaeron. When he returned in triumph in 976, he granted the knights lands for a citadel and freed them from the jurisdiction of monarchs. They were still judges, and they travelled the 9 duchies of the realm. They were the arbiters, scrupulously fair. As the years passed, the orders gained more rules. No wealth, for that could lead to corruption. Wives were forbidden to the Gabala knights, for families could be threatened in order to extort favourable decisions. It was an honour to be chosen.
but the price was high. But what of Olothair? Lamphada asked. Patience, boy. The knights were chosen by the armorer. When one died or was killed, the armorer would travel the lands to find a successor.
Why the armorer? Was he not a servant?
The armorer was the father of the order. He supplied not only the magic armor they wore, but also the spiritual armor. He alone could command the Gabala. Olothair was the last armorer.
What happened to the knights?
No one truly knows. But the king sent a messenger to Samil Danach, the Lord Knight, requesting a special favor. It is said that his request took the knights to a world of demons, where they battle still for the good of the realm. I do not know what became of them. It was the first year of the new king's reign. Perhaps he had them poisoned, for they ruled against him in several disputes. Or perhaps they were killed by assassins. Perhaps they fled to another land. Whatever their fate, the armorer Olothair was taken by the king's men and imprisoned. He died in Firbolg. Why the interest in a dead sorcerer?
I don't know, Lamphada lied. It just interests me.
The realm could do with them now. The knights, I mean, said Nuada. Just what we need, agreed Clor Givis sardonically, pushing shut the door behind him and walking to the fire. A handful of knights in pretty armor. I'm sure they would sway the king.
They were more than knights, said Nuada, and greater than heroes. Do not mock them.
Clor warmed his hands before the fire. You poets never see reality, do you? Everything is part of some great romance. You came here looking for a rebel leader and found only an outlawed blacksmith. That is reality. The knights were just men, and they knew greed and lust and despair just like all of us. Don't make gods of them, Nuada.
I'll agree to that, Clor Givis. But do not make fools of them either, for they were all better men than you.
That is not difficult, Clor agreed, slapping Nuada on the shoulder. But I'm alive, when many better men are dead. And I will remain so, by looking after my own interests, and leaving the heroics to you and your sagas.
The once knight rode up the hill dismounting before the charred remains of the house of Olothair. The stallion, Cuan, stood nervous and afraid. As the acrid smoke swirled to his flaring nostrils, he whinnied and backed away. The once knight stroked the stallion's neck.
It's all right, Greatheart. It is only the ruins of a house. There is no harm here. Wait for me.
Carefully he picked his way through the embers, searching for any sign of a body, but there was nothing. Returning to the stallion, he loosened the saddle cloth and lifted his food sack from the pommel. There was precious little left, 3 honey cakes and a canvas bag of oats. He fed one of the cakes to Cuan and ate the other 2. Then he drew water from the well and drank, leaving the bucket for the stallion to slake his thirst. Olothair was gone. Taken by the armed men? He doubted it. Would they have destroyed the house? Perhaps. But there was no sign of a struggle. He saw tracks close to the well and knelt by them. Paw marks. Deep and sharp.
Lions? Here, so close to a town?
He stood and followed the tracks for a little way. Men running, slipping and sliding down the hill, the beasts bounding after them. He grinned, then laughed aloud. But this increased the pressure on his throat and he calmed himself. The beasts had padded back to the house where 2 men had stood. The once knight knelt again. The paw marks suddenly became deeper. He thought for a moment, then noticed that some of the boot marks coming from the house were deep also. Olothair had loaded the lions with packs and set off towards the forested mountains 4, maybe 5 hours ago.
Cuan whinnied, his head turning towards the trail to the town. The once knight stood and saw a party of riders galloping towards the gutted house. Swiftly he dragged his foot over the tracks. Then he tightened Cuan's saddle cinch and mounted, leading the stallion forward to disturb the ground still further. As the riders neared, he saw they were all wearing breastplates bearing a painted raven on the chest. There were some 15 men in the party.
"Good day to you," said the once knight.
"What are you doing here?"
demanded a lean, hawk-faced man.
"I saw the smoke and wondered if anyone needed help. I take it you're upon the same business."
"My business is none of your concern. Who are you?"
"I, sir, am a man of manners," the once knight replied, "and ill-suited to conversation with men of no breeding."
The riders sat very quietly, waiting for a response from their captain. His face burned red and his dark eyes narrowed as he heeled his mount forward.
"It ill becomes a stranger to insult an officer of the Duke. Apologize, sir, or I shall be forced to deal with you."
The once knight leaned forward on the pommel of his saddle.
"When last I met the Duke, he had won the Silver Lance for his prowess on the jousting field. I recall him saying that a gentleman should learn three things. Honor, that he might bring it to his name. Swordsmanship, so that none could take his honor from him. And humility, so that he could always see where honor lay."
"You are a friend of the Duke."
"I'm the man he beat in the tourney. But then I was always better with a sword than with a lance."
The captain thought for a moment, then came to a swift decision.
My apologies, sir, if my words caused offence. But we are hunting an outlaw, and the Duke has charged me with his capture."
"Your apology is accepted, and allow me to offer my own. I have travelled far, and I fear my temper is short. Tell me, do you seek a heavyset man travelling with three large beasts?"
"I do indeed, sir. Have you seen him?"
"About 2 hours ago, that way," answered the once knight, pointing away from the forest. "I thought the creatures might be lions, but I did not see them closely."
"Oh, thanks to you, sir knight.
Are you heading for Macther?"
"The Duke is in residence, and I'm sure he would be delighted to see you again."
"I think perhaps I will. Good luck in your hunt."
As the riders thundered away, the once knight tugged on the reins and touched his heels to Cuan's side. The forest was maybe 2 hours' ride, and with luck he would find Olaf there before nightfall. As he rode, he remembered his joust with the Duke. The man was a skilled horseman and a deadly lancer. Had the tips of the weapons not been covered with wooden plugs, the lance would have pierced his heart. Even so, he had endured the pain of 2 cracked ribs. It was a shame the man's character was not as well honed as his skills. The Duke had not uttered the words he credited him with. These had been said by the Lord Knight Samuel Danach as a reproof to the Duke. The once knight grinned as he thought of Samuel Danach, a true knight and a man of great humility. Had the Duke found the temerity to challenge Samuel Danach, the outcome would have been considerably different. Memories of his friend flooded back, filling him with sadness. Samuel Danach riding to the joust against the King of Sithéron's champion, or in single combat against the rebel Duke of Terrain, or leading the prayers at the Citadel, or dancing with Morrigan at the Feast of Souls. There never was a better knight of the Gabala, he thought, or a better friend.
"I am sorry I betrayed you," murmured the once knight.
Furious when the report of this escape of Erin's nomad servants was brought to him, Orkessa took the news to the Duke and demanded Erin's arrest.
The Duke in turn berated Erin, but accepted his assurance that his servants had run away, stealing some 200 rack in gold in the process.
"You are a dreadful fool, Erin," said the Duke. "But then you have always believed the best of people. Now you see, do you not, that these people cannot be trusted?"
"Indeed I do, my lord. I curse myself for my stupidity."
"It cannot be helped. Akessa would like you hanged, but it is one pleasure I shall deny him. After all, where would I find another lord of the feast? And who would prepare the swans cooked in wine?"
Erin smiled.
"And the quail, my lord." "Indeed, the quail. Far more simple to acquire another lord's seer. By the way, one of the king's knights will be here sometime today to finalize the arrangements for the visit. Make him welcome, would you?"
"Of course, my lord," Erin answered, bowing and leaving the room. Okessa was waiting in the hallway. His eyes shone with malice and sweat gleamed on his bald pate.
"Do not think," he hissed, "that you fool me. You conspire to allow those nomads to escape justice, just as you did not tell me about Ruad Rofessa. But you will fall, Lord Erin, and I will spit upon your grave."
"What a charmless man you are, Okessa. And as for this Ruad, do not forget that I came to you concerning Olothair. How was I to know that he was alive and living in the duchy under another name? You are said to be a seer. Surely you should have been able to find him. Or are your powers fading?"
Okessa smiled.
"We will see, Lord Erin. I cast your horoscope this morning. In 5 days, your life will face a critical time, so critical that you might not survive. How does that please you?"
Erin swallowed hard and tried to force a smile. But it did not fool Okessa, who chuckled and stalked away. Erin lifted a trembling hand to his face. He was angry with himself for showing fear, but he knew Okessa would not have lied to him.
What would be his purpose? No, Erin was sentenced to death. How would it come? Poison? Suffocation? A fall? A stray arrow?
His first urge was to run to his home and flee to Firbolg. He had friends there, but what would the Duke make of his flight?
No, he was trapped. He wished Ubadai was close. The little nomad had a nose for trouble and would die to protect him.
Not that Erin wanted anyone to die for him, but it was pleasant to know that Ubadai was asleep outside his door. If an ant broke wind in the meadow outside, the nomad would be instantly awake. Without him, Erin felt isolated and vulnerable. That night he slept badly, his door barred, the windows shuttered and locked. In the morning he bathed and dressed in a green tunic of eastern silk, embroidered with gold thread, soft boots, and a cap of yellow-dyed wool edged with the softest leather. Okessa's threat seemed less dreadful on this bright morning, and with the king's knight due, the Lord Seer was unlikely to risk an assassination. Erin was determined to make a fine impression on the knight. As matters stood, he needed all the friends he could get. It was sunset before the knight arrived, and Erin was relieved when the guard on the watchtower signaled a rider approaching. Erin and the Duke hurried down to the gate to greet him. The knight wore crimson armor and rode a great black stallion of some 17 hands. The rider's visor was down, and the sun was setting behind him as he made his slow progress to the castle gate, where he drew to a halt under the portcullis.
"Welcome, Sir Knight," said the Duke.
"My horse is to be stabled alone," said the knight.
his voice muffled by the helm. No other beast must be present.
Of course, said the Duke, nonplussed.